Okay, I'm glad to see you all back. It's been a long break. We are up to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. This is lesson 9. We're going to be talking about discontent with worldly success. So I'm going to start reading Ecclesiastes 5 at verse 8 and read through part of chapter 6. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor, the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go, and what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy in his heart. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place? All the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for a man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? We have been following Solomon's quest in the book of Ecclesiastes to find the meaning of life. It's no light matter. What is the point? What makes life worth living? What is the good life? He has felt that sense of eternity that God has placed in the human heart, and he's been frustrated by it because he's not been able to find what he's looking for down here under the sun. So much of Ecclesiastes is talking about what we find down under the sun, which is the realm of this world, what we can perceive as human beings by our senses without direct revelation from God, who is above the sun. Nature and human history, Solomon says, seem to be going in circles. They're never making any progress, really. The world is full of injustice and suffering, and it repeats itself every generation. Nobody remembers or learns from history. Although there is beauty in the world, we never get to see the complete picture of that because we don't live long enough. We're stuck down here under the sun, scrabbling through life, haunted by a desire for transcendence, taunted by the sense that there's something more, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know how to find it. That's the experience of humanity under the sun without the interaction with God, without God revealing himself. So, in his quest to find meaning, Solomon has explored scholarship, sensuality, that's self-indulgent pleasure, morality, being careful to do the right thing practically and morally responsible, and hard work, that is building and accomplishing things. He's looked in all these places to find the answer, but none of them have provided the satisfaction that he's looking for. He's even gone to church, as we found in our last lesson, way back before the break, the house of God, and he's been frustrated by what he found there, too. He finds a bunch of stupid people going through the motions, talking too much, making foolish vows, and acting as if the God they came to worship is not really a big deal. That's discouraging. In the passage we're looking at today, Solomon turns to wealth, riches, money. You know, maybe this is the answer to that ache I find in my heart, to that needing something more. Maybe money can provide that. And so that's what we're looking at today. The value of worldly success. Now, there's more to success than money. But generally speaking, in the sight of the world, what makes somebody successful is that they're wealthy and they can get whatever they want, supposedly. So riches. What do riches get you? Well, as we said, respect, admiration of the world. Proverbs 14:20 says, "The poor are shunned by even their neighbors, but the rich have many friends." Everybody wants to be around the rich person. They want to be associated with him. They want to kind of cash in on his success. So if I'm hanging out with the rich guy, people are going to look at me like I'm kind of like respectable like he is. I want to hang out with the poor people, you know, because they're losers. And if I hang out with the rich guy, you know, maybe he'll throw some money my way. Maybe they're not real friends, but it sure feels good when you're the one receiving all this attention. The next thing that riches provide or that people think they provide is security, safety. Proverbs 18:11 says, "The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it an unscalable wall." So that's very tempting. We look to riches to protect us. If we have enough money, we will be taken care of in the future. If we have enough money, we can afford health care. If we have enough money, we will be taken care of when we're old. We can make choices. We're not going to be on the mercy of somebody else. So money makes us feel secure. And wealth, money also provides influence and a feeling of control. Like I have control of my own life because I have money. Proverbs 22:7 says, "The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is the slave to the lender." So the guy that has money or the girl that has money has a lot of influence. If you need money, you're living hand to mouth, and your employer asks you to do something that you don't really feel good about doing, but then he says, well, you know, if you don't do what I say, I need to get another employee, not you, you know. So doesn't that tend to compromise your conscience when you're bound up in money, when you need money? It limits your choices. And when you have money, you think, oh, I have all the choices in the world. I can do whatever I want. So those are the things that wealth itself kind of makes us feel like we have these attributes. A couple other things that he mentions, though, here that make people a success in the sight of the world are a little bit, he doesn't go into great depth, but I think they're worth touching on. He mentions long life. You know, there's this guy that didn't enjoy his life, but he had a really long life. And then he says, even if he lived, you know, 100 years, 1,000 years, twice over, it's not good enough if he didn't enjoy his life. So anyway, long life was considered a blessing from God. Everybody wants to live a long life. Well, most people do. We're obsessed with it today in our culture. Every culture has been obsessed with it. You know, if this is all there is, this is all we know, then time is the most precious commodity. We want to enjoy as much as we can of life, accomplish as many things as we can. And so in the scripture, very often, God's blessing was seen in a man being able to see his children's children. So to be able to live long enough to see that. Then he also mentions, Solomon mentions, having many children. That it makes you successful in the sight of the world. And I think this is worth a minute here because in our culture, this is not the case. Fertility, the ability to produce children, was highly prized in biblical culture. The whole worth of a woman, in most cases, was based on her ability to produce children. And if she produced lots of boys, she was all that. Fertility, children, have been valued by most of the world for most of human history. We are in a very strange period in our culture right now where we despise fertility and we don't value children. Well, we spoil them to death, but, you know, we could kill them before they're born, and we don't really want them to you know, cramp our style. They're portrayed as leeches, parasites, inconveniences by our society. And you see a whole generation coming up that doesn't want to have children. In fact, they think it's immoral to have children because they're wrecking the world. There's too many people, they say. That's really odd, and it's not biblical. So anyway, what were they wanting in children? What was that providing for them that maybe we can relate to? Well, first of all, it had a very practical purpose to have a lot of children. In an agricultural society, which it was, you need labor. You need people to work the fields. You need people to take care of the home. You need people to milk the goats and the cows. And you need protection. So lots of people, there's strength in numbers. Particularly if you have some strong men coming up, you know, you have more security. And your children were your investment for the future. Your children would take care of you when you're old. So those are all things that we do value, but we don't tend to find those in children. The second thing, the idea behind having many children being a good thing, is the prestige. And it was very prestigious to have many children. It kind of proved in this culture, and in many cultures still does, virility, manly prowess. I could produce this many children, you know. I could start my own clan. I'm the ruler of all this, you know, and I'm virile and fertile and the source of all this. It provides your children coming up in the world, particularly if you've raised them well. If they're respected in the city gate, it talks about that the children of a righteous man are found at the city gate. They're leaders in their community. And so they have influence in society. And who taught them their values? You did. So you have influence in society, and the more children you have, the more influence you have. And then they provide a legacy for you, your children. We don't live forever, so we want to be remembered. We want the things that we've worked for to last, to go into the next generation, to continue to influence the world. And so children provide that. They give a legacy. They give continued influence and keep your memory alive. So many children at this time was a blessing from God and was part of what made you respected in the world. Now, in our culture, money takes the place of all that. We think money can do all that for us. That's pretty cold, but that's the way it is. The last thing he mentions as being really important is a good burial. Okay. What exactly is a good burial? Well, look at the pharaohs in Egypt. You know, it was lavish. You know, they buried all their wealth with them and, you know, wrote inscriptions about them and killed their slaves so they could serve them in the next life. And, you know, that was a great burial. It was very impressive. Okay, most people didn't have that. But your funeral and your burial, which were kind of together in that day, it's the last impression you make on this earth. Your family and friends come to pay their last respects to you, and your community takes notice. It was embarrassing to you and to your family if you didn't have money enough when you died to provide a decent burial. It was a great disrespect if you weren't buried well, you weren't made a big deal about. It meant either that you didn't have enough money or that you didn't have family who cared about you enough to give you a respectable burial. Think about in the time of Jesus, you know, when he brought the little girl back from the dead, and when he showed up, everybody's weeping and wailing, and, you know, it mentions the professional wailers. Like, you actually hire people to come in to make a big deal about this, to weep and wail and show that we're really sorry you're gone. So a good burial is important. It's the last memory of you. It shows what people thought of you. It shows what you accomplished in life. And so Solomon says, you know, what if you have everything good in life, but then it comes to your last day, and you know what? You die, and you didn't enjoy anything, and nobody loves you, and that's it. You were working for the wind. You have nothing to show for your life. This is one of the paradoxes of messianic prophecy. This is kind of like taking a little rabbit trail here, but think about Jesus, how he died and was buried. Isaiah 53 says, "By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants?" He didn't have any children. "For he was cut off from the land of the living. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death." Isaiah 53, talking about these things that kind of, at the time, probably made no sense to people who were reading it. But we see it through the lens of fulfillment, Jesus. Jesus had no physical descendants. He wasn't married. He didn't have children. Now, there's a popular heresy that pops up every now and then that says, oh, yeah, Jesus really married Mary Magdalene, and they have this bloodline coming down. No, that misses the whole point of the gospel. Jesus had no physical descendants. He was assigned a grave with the wicked. He was totally innocent, but he was executed as a criminal on a cross, which was the most shameful death you could have. But he was honored in his burial. Isaiah 53 says, "Yet he will see his offspring and prolong his days." Who's his offspring? We're his offspring. He will live again. He was resurrected. And God says, "I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for transgressors." So think about this. Jesus, although he's innocent, died the death of a criminal for us, but he was looked at as being shameful, and people were wagging their heads at him and shaking their fingers and saying, see, Isaiah says he was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering and grief. That's how he was viewed in his death. But God made sure he had an honorable burial before his passion. He was anointed with precious oil, very costly oil, by Mary of Bethany. And Jesus said, she's done a beautiful thing. She has prepared me for my burial. And then, after he was dead on the cross, Joseph of Arimathea comes, gets permission to take his body down, and he takes him to his own tomb, the tomb of a rich man. And if you understand the passage that's talking about him, all the spices he put in there and laid him, you know, in a cloth, that was enough spices to honor a king. That's what a king would be buried with. And so here's Jesus having a good burial. All right, that was a little off track, but just thought it was cool. So those are, you know, if you have wealth, you should be able to have those things. You have the sense of security, control, power, choice. Everybody respects you, admires you. You think you have options. You can be kind of bossy and tell other people what to do. You know, you're in a good place. You're sitting pretty. And ideally, when you die, you have a great burial and everybody goes, wow, that's what I wish I had. But now Solomon gets into the vanity of wealth. He says, you know, if anybody's going to know about wealth, it will be Solomon, the richest man in the world. And he comes away saying, it was empty. It's empty. It can't do what you think. You know, at the end of my life, I'm looking at this and I'm going, it was a waste. What did I labor for? You know, it's the wind. Because, first point, it won't satisfy. It's never enough. He who loves money will never have enough money. There's always something more you want. And the more money you have, the more you tend to live beyond your means. And there's always one more thing. Somebody asked John D. Rockefeller, you know, a really rich guy in recent history, you know, how much is enough? And he said, just a little bit more. In that obnoxious TV cartoon, The Simpsons, Mr. Burns is Homer's boss, and he's like the rich, really rich. And Homer says to him, you're the richest guy I know. And Mr. Burns says, yeah, and I trade it all for a little bit more. It's never enough if that's what you're looking to. The other problem with it is other people can take it from you, and they will. You have a lot of money, and you get married, you have kids, you have lots of kids. You want lots of kids because, you know, you look good in the world and you have influence, but they eat a lot of food. And then you need to hire slaves and workers to take care of everything, and they eat a lot of food, and you got to pay them. And then you get, you know, all these distant relatives and freeloaders that show up and want a little bit of your money. And other people can take it. Here's an interesting thing he says. He talks about riches that were kept by the owner to his hurt. There's a lot of ways that having wealth and riches can actually hurt you. Number one, you have more ways to die. Think about it. Okay, most of us, you know, we can walk out and get hit by a car, we can die of a disease, whatever. Okay, but if you're rich and you have all these toys and gadgets and you're jet-setting all over the planet, you know, you can die in a car, fast car, you can die in an airplane, you can die in a sailboat, a motorboat, a yacht, skiing, you got more toys, you got more extreme behavior. A lot of rich people really kind of go up in flames from their toys. So that's one way it could hurt you. Secondly, it makes you a target. If you're rich and you have all this stuff, people look at you and they want your stuff. And so you can become a victim of theft, murder. People might kidnap your kids, so you pay them money for ransom. They want what you have. And if you're rich, well, you can afford to pay the ransom. That's why they take your kids, you know. But if you're poor, you don't need ransom because nobody wants what you have. So it being rich makes you a target. In fact, a lot of people that won the lottery, you know, we all think, oh, if I could win the lottery, that would be great. You know, look at all the good things I could do. I could pay off all my debts. You know, I'd have the wonderful life. I'd live the good life. And most people say it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And they end up losing it all. And they end up in debt. It corrupts your character. It can. Now, money and riches themselves are not bad. It's not bad to be rich. There's nothing wonderful and spiritual in being poor in and of itself. It's not the stuff. It's not what you have. It's your attitude toward it. But if you're very rich, there's a lot of temptation that comes with that. Mainly, it distracts you from the state of your soul. It makes you proud, and you feel like you don't need God. Makes you think you can boss other people around, take advantage of other people. It can corrupt you. And then it controls you. It ends up controlling you. The more you invest in it, the harder it is to let it go. And if you can't let it go and walk away, it will control you. And it can be used to manipulate you. You've probably heard the story before of the monkey trap that in Africa, you know, to catch this monkey, they have a gourd and they put a bunch of peanuts in it and they have this little hole just big enough for the monkey to stick his hand in and get a handful of peanuts. But then he can't pull it back out again. And it's chained to something. And the man's coming with a club to beat the monkey over the head and kill him. And the monkey won't let go of the stuff. And it ends up being the death of him. That's very often how it is with riches and wealth. To people who get it here, they can't let it go. And if you can't walk away, you're not free. Now, some people can be very wealthy and walk away. It's not a temptation to them. This is not just a problem with rich people. Poor people can be very greedy. They can put all their hope in being rich. And a lot of times, you know, people that are really rich, particularly their kids, you see this, they're the ones that become saints. They're like, this is nothing. I don't need this stuff. I walk away, you think of St. Francis pulling off all his clothes, throwing his dad's stuff all away and just going off on his own and saying, it's not what it's cracked up to be and I don't need it. But if you've never had it, it's very tempting to think, if I just had that, life would be good. Anyway, it can be lost. It can be lost with a bad investment. You can say, well, that was your fault if you'd invested more wisely. But, you know, that's not the only thing that can get you. It could be somebody else's fault that you lose your money. Maybe your husband squandered it. The government takes it away from you. They make all these regulations on your business so that you can't function, you can't survive. A fluke of nature, you know, a tornado could strike, a flood could come and wash your house away, and you could die of corona and, you know, whatever, you know, things happen. It's not in your control to hold on to this. Jesus said, don't store up treasure here, or it can be lost. Rust will get it. Moths will get it. People will steal it. And you can't take it with you. Psalm 49 says, be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. That's not that we're afraid of rich people, but we kind of get overawed and we give them a little more prowess than they deserve and we feel less than. He says, don't do that. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go down to the generation of his fathers who will never again see the light. See, death is the great leveler. You know, it doesn't matter how rich you are here, you are not going to escape death, and nobody can take anything with them. And wealth, it causes you to worry. Making it, maintaining it, protecting it. More is not always better. The more you have, the more you have to take care of. Somebody said to me the other day, if I had a bigger house, I'd have to buy more furniture. And I'm thinking to myself, if I had a bigger house and had more furniture, then I'd have to hire somebody to clean it all. It takes on a life of its own. And you keep thinking you need more. And you move into a higher circle of, you know, people that move there. And you think, oh, I need to have what they have. And it can become a cause of worry. And Solomon mentions here the physical impact of that on you. He talks about insomnia, not being able to sleep at night because you're worrying about your stuff. He talks about indigestion because it could be because you're anxious, or it could be because you just eat all this rich food, and at nighttime your tummy hurts. And the emotional toll, he talks about anxiety, anger, bitterness, eating all your food in the dark. You know, you get up early before dawn to eat, and you don't go to bed until late at night when it's dark, and, you know, your life is just this constant frenzy. So it takes a toll physically and emotionally. And at the end of all that, Solomon says, basically, is it worth it? Is it worth it when you die? He says in chapter 5, verse 16, what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? And Jesus asks a very similar question in Mark 8. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Now, I want to say just a little bit about the problem of greed, because greed drives this whole thing. What is that? What's going on? Greed. First of all, again, this is a problem for everyone, not just rich people. It can be a really bad problem for poor people, too. But it's this mindset, basically, of materialism, that the physical world is all there is, or at least it's the most important thing. Here and now, what I can have. So I want all the good stuff, and I want it here and now, and this is what life is about. Okay? So, materialism. Secondly, it shows a lack of charity. The misery of the miserly. Hoarding for yourself. Taking advantage of others to get rich. Resenting people who have more than you do. It shows that you're not loving your neighbor as yourself. You think you deserve more and better than everyone else, or at least as much and as good as everyone else has. And if somebody has more than you, you're just not going to be happy. Well, you're not loving your neighbor. And thirdly, and this is where all of this comes from, it's an indication of idolatry. Jesus said, you cannot serve both God and money. Can't do it. You're going to choose one over the other, and guess which one you choose? It'll be the money. The Apostle Paul equates greed with idolatry in Colossians 3:5. And he says to Timothy, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Now, just because in the past this hasn't been a problem for you doesn't mean it won't be a problem for you in the future. Just because you've passed the test before doesn't mean that the next minute you're not going to feel differently. This is always a temptation to us. And in our culture that highly prizes prosperity, you know, we've made it a greed of virtue in our society. It's a constant temptation, and we need to search our hearts and examine ourselves for this. If money is the most important thing to you, the thing that overshadows everything else in your life, you have a problem with idolatry. If you think money will solve your problems, that's idolatry. If you think it will validate you as a human being and make you worthy and important, you're looking to the wrong thing. It can't do that. If you envy and resent anyone who has more than you do, you have a problem. If money's the bottom line for you that outweighs relationships, morality, and everything else, you have a problem. And we kid ourselves. You know, we think, oh, I don't have that problem. You know, I would choose God. You know, I would, if I had a choice between money and God, of course I'd choose God. Well, would you? Do you put your job above God, above the church? Do you, when push comes to shove, shove someone else to get what you need? very often when it comes right down to it, people just say, well, you know, I had to, you know, I need money. I got to feed myself, you know. If money's the bottom line for you, you're willing to sin against God to get it, or to abuse or steal from someone else to get it, you have a problem. If you think money will make you happy, and that you can't be happy unless you have just a little bit more, you have a problem. You know, I'm talking to myself. I have a problem. I'm going to be like, ew. If I ever speak to some sin very powerfully, it's probably because I've experienced it and I understand it. Okay. So, in this case, you know, you're worshiping wealth. You're valuing the gift above the giver. You're valuing creation above the creator. You expect things to provide for you something that only God can provide. Self-worth, safety, joy, whatever it is. Secondly, this one kind of struck me, because I didn't see this at first, but you're scorning providence. You're discontent with the provision of God. You're not properly grateful for what God has given you. And how often is that not the case? You know, we have so much. Most people in the world look at even poor people in America and think, you have it made. You know, we have so much. And what are we thinking about? Are we thinking, God, thank you. Thank you. I have a roof over my head. I have clothes to wear. I have clean water to drink. I have access to medical care. I can walk. I'm healthy. You know, I have food in my refrigerator. I can drive a car. You know, are we delighted constantly by all these things? No. We take them for granted and we think about the one thing we don't have. All the way back to the Garden of Eden. You know, you can have any tree in the garden, you got it made, but no, we want that one tree that you said we can't have. When you scorn providence and you're not content with what God gives you and you're not grateful, you're saying, God, I know better than you what's good for me. And I think you're being stingy. You're holding out on me. And I don't trust you to provide what I need. You know, what do we need? Solomon says, you know, all our labor's for our mouth. You know, we need to eat. We need to survive. But we think we need so much more. And the more we get, the more we think we need. But how much can you eat? There are new mercies every morning. We don't want to be like those stubborn Israelites in the wilderness who tried to hoard manna. Do you remember what happened? This is one of the funnier stories in the Bible, I think. God tells them, okay, go out every morning and collect what you need. Just enough for that day. Don't take more than you need. Well, some of these people think, okay, it came today, but it might not be there tomorrow, so I'm going to, you know, hoard up a little bit, and what happens? You know, they go in the next morning and look at it, and it's full of worms. I love it. Worms. Ah! Okay, then he says, okay, on the Sabbath, I'm not going to give you any. So that night, you know, before, you collect twice as much so that you can eat it on Sabbath. Now, it's probably the same people that had the worms. They didn't trust God the first time and said, oh, no, 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 I'm not saving any animal worms in my cupboard. You know, come out the next morning, and it's gone. Okay. The point is, God provides for us. It's the relationship. He's got this. It's not up to us, ultimately. And then we complain about the bread from heaven. Oh, this is boring. I want meat. You know, yeah, I was a slave in Egypt, but we had really good meat. You know, how often are we willing to be slaves just, you know, to satiate our hunger and, you know, something that tastes good and is exciting? Scorning the providence of God is a serious thing. And it's also serving ourselves when we worship wealth. It's trying to be God. It's saying, you know, we can look to the thing and think, that's God, that will save me. But really, it's like, I want to be my own God, and I want to get the things that I want. I don't have to acknowledge God. I don't want to have to rely on him to protect me and provide for me and give me security and give me joy. Because I don't think he's going to do a good job of that. I'm going to be my own God. I know what's good for me, and I will get it. Solomon says, "There's an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them. This is vanity. It's a grievous evil. His soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial. I say a stillborn child is better off than he." Stillborn child, you know, they didn't even live. They didn't have the embarrassment of laboring for the wind and all the heartache that comes with it. They die and they're gone and they go to their rest. Well, this crazy miser, you know, he's been miserable his whole life and he hasn't enjoyed anything. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the same place. Everybody dies. They all go to the grave. So finally, I want to talk about the ability to enjoy things. You can have everything good that the world has to offer and not enjoy it. And what's the point of that? It's quite common, actually. Look at American culture. Even our poor people would be considered rich by most of the world. But we take more antidepressants and have more mental illness than any other country in the world. And rich people are often more depressed and dysfunctional than the rest of us. Now, I'm not saying anything against antidepressants. I've benefited from them. Depression, you know, there may be other causes of this too. But I'm just pointing out, you know, we have so much. Why are we not happy? God has given us so much to enjoy. And we're not happy. "Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun in the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart." So he's not there languishing about, you know, it's the meaning of life. I'm so depressed. What am I going to do? He's working. He's enjoying life. And he's not thinking about the misery. He's enjoying what God's given him. So enjoyment comes from our attitude, and it comes from our relationship with God. It doesn't come from things, because you can have all the things in the world and not have any enjoyment. And our God is the God of joy. He expects us to enjoy what he's given us. He's not happy when we don't enjoy his gifts. Somehow we get in our minds sometimes that it's so spiritual that we don't want to have any stuff, and if we have stuff, we don't want to enjoy it, because that's just not spiritual. What? You know? Or, you know, how's that helping anyone? Being miserable? How's that honoring God? If he's given you this, he wants you to enjoy it. But we have to understand, you know, life itself is a gift from God. Psalm 100 verse 3 says, "The Lord, he is God. It is he who has made us, not we ourselves." We Americans think we make ourselves. You know, scripture says, we don't make ourselves. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. He's the shepherd. You know, so we need to understand our lives are not by accident. We didn't just poof come up out of the primordial goop and I'm here by accident. Well, I might as well make the best of it, try to enjoy it. No, we're not here by accident. And we didn't make ourselves. Scripture tells us that God knew us before we were born. He had planned the days in the book for us, how long we would live. He established where we would live. He's given us work to do. He's given us a calling. Life is a gift from God, and he expects us to enjoy it. And we can enjoy it when we understand that. Okay, in reference to God, we got to look beyond the sun. There's more than this. This is my portion. You know, the way it reads, it's like, this is your lot, make the best of it. You know, that's kind of how I read it when I, you know, have breezed over it before. It's like, okay, well, you got all this toil under the sun, you just got a short amount of time to live, this is your lot, make the best of it. I don't think that's what it's saying. He's saying, this is my portion. This is what God has given me personally. And he doesn't give us all the same. He doesn't give all his kids the same thing. All his kids don't need the same thing. All his kids aren't supposed to do the same thing. To some people, wealth is not a danger, but to most of us, it is. God knows what's good for us. He knows what we can handle. He knows that most of us should not win the lottery. It would be the worst thing that ever happened to us. He really wants our joy. And so he's given us exactly what we need to make us who we need to be so that we can enjoy it. This is my portion. God has chosen this for me, my life, my inheritance. Psalm 47:4 says, he chose our inheritance for us. He chose my family. He chose my home. He chose my situation in life. My work is my portion. This is what God has called me to. I have things to do. You know, we're not just here bored out of our minds with nothing to do. He's given us things to do, and they're meaningful things and important things and enjoyable things because God gave them to us and because we're not laboring for ourselves and our own kingdom. If we were, it would be vanity. But for his, you know, God created Adam and Eve to work the garden, have dominion over the earth. And as we do that, we take dominion in our little area, in our little home, in our little skill set, with our little friends. We're making the world a better place. That's meaningful. That's good. God gave it to us. We're exercising dominion over the earth, and we're building his kingdom. So my work, God's given it to me. It's a good thing, and I'm supposed to enjoy it, do it cheerfully, not grudgingly. And my daily bread comes down to this. You know, everything's about our mouth. You know, from the time you're a tiny little baby, what do you do? As soon as you get a hold of something, it goes in the mouth. Most important thing, eating, surviving. Okay, so it comes down to our mouth. Here's where the rubber meets the road. Do we trust God for our daily bread? When I look at life in relationship to God and I understand who he is, I understand that God gives me what I need every day. Jesus taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread. We don't need to be hoarding manna. I don't need to work myself to death. I don't need to hoard. I don't need to be afraid of what might happen in the future. I need to live in this day. God has given me this day. God has given me what I have in front of me. This day is packed with beauty. It's packed with grace. And when I start worrying about the future, I'm missing all the good here. And I'm not helping the future, you know. And half of that stuff, I imagine, won't even happen. But I'm making myself miserable, and I'm missing the fruit that tastes good and the sunshine that's so beautiful and the, you know, the person that comes to talk to me and, you know, the laugh of a baby. You know, all these things. God's packed our days with enjoyment. Are we enjoying it? He's a God of joy. He gives his people joy. There are new mercies every morning. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. His faithfulness is great. Here's the thing. You know, as Christians, we understand this better than the people of Solomon's time. I am not an orphan in the world. I'm not left alone to scrounge through the trash heap of life in order to find what I need. I don't have to fight off the other beggars for a scrap of bread. I have a father who loves me, and he will provide for me. The Lord will provide. Throughout the scripture, we see it time and time and time and time and time again. The Israelites in the wilderness, how long did it take them? 40 years, and did they even get it then? You know, I got this. I will provide for you. We got manna, we got quail, we got water from rocks. Your shoes are not going to wear out. Your clothes are not going to wear out. I got this. And every little turn in the road, they're like, we don't have what we need. We want to go back to Egypt. You know, he's got this. Jesus said, the pagans run after the things of this world. They run after, you know, what am I going to eat? What am I going to drink? What clothes am I going to wear? And he's like, your father knows you need these things. You're not a pagan. You're not an orphan. God's got this. Don't worry. Pagans run after the things that money can buy. To a pagan, being rich is like the ultimate. That's the closest to being almighty God that you'll ever be, is being the richest person on earth. They're obsessed with it. But our Father knows what we need, and he's promised to provide. We don't have to be obsessed with it. Hebrews 13 tells us, keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? It's that God consciousness that provides the security, the enjoyment, everything we need. And so knowing that, it's gratitude that produces the joy. Gratitude to God. God wants us to enjoy life, even though it's broken. Yeah, we got to deal with the reality. Solomon's been dealing with the reality the whole way through. And he's been very honest with us. He doesn't sugarcoat anything. He comes to the point where he's like, I hate this life. It's broken. It doesn't work. Nothing satisfies. And we have to come to that before we can find joy where it really is. But God wants us to enjoy life. Thing is, all the good things that he's put in this world, all the good things he gives us can only be enjoyed in relationship with him. The things can never satisfy us. Only God can satisfy us. And here's the other thing. You know, whew, I'm not God. What a relief. God's my Father. He's taking care of me. Paul wrote this to Timothy, 1 Timothy 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Money's not bad. Money can be a good thing, and if God has given it to you, enjoy it. Just don't love it. Don't make it your God. Now, here's the thing. Solomon says, you know, God's given this man all this stuff, but he didn't give him the power to enjoy it. I don't know about you, but that seems kind of like not fair to me. It just seems like, well, that's kind of cruel. Why? Is it fair that God doesn't give some people the ability to enjoy the good things that they have? So in order to answer that, I kind of had to stand back and kind of look at it from a different angle. And then I realized that's a really passive way to look at your relationship with God. That's not all there is. We can ask for contentment. We can learn to be content. If we have God, that's possible. And if it's to somebody who refuses to acknowledge God, they're not going to be content. They don't have the capacity to enjoy it because they're idolizing things of this world. And when you put your trust and all your confidence in something in this world, it will crumble under the weight of your worship. That food that you think is so wonderful will turn to ashes in your mouth. That man that you think is so wonderful that you're going to marry, you know, you are going to be so disappointed when you figure out he's not Jesus. Oh, my goodness. I mean, that just accounts for so much of our frustration in life. You know, we're looking to people or things that are not God to give us what only God can give us. But when we realize they're not meant to be that, we have the source of all that. Think of the first question of the Westminster Catechism. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. Not just his things. He's the source of all the things. He is delight itself. He's joy. He gives it to us constantly, every day. If we have him, we can be happy with anything. If we don't have him, we can have everything and be miserable for our entire lives. Die. And nobody cares. Godliness with contentment is great gain. And we can have contentment because of the relationship with God. We know who he is. Paul says, I have learned in whatever situation I am in to be content. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. A lot of times we take that last verse kind of out of context. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You know, I'm going to be Superman. I can, you know, whatever. And yes, he can strengthen you to do amazing things. But it's really talking about I can live in any circumstance. I can be rich. I can be poor. I can have any of these things. And I can still be content because I have Jesus. He gives me what I need. He strengthens me. He's enough. So let me just close with this. The world is broken. Yes, it is. Our hearts are broken. We're not right. The world is not right. There's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of sadness. But God has not abandoned us. He still provides for us. He determines what each one of us should have, and it's good for us, and it is for our joy. So work cheerfully. Trust God. Enjoy life. And don't hoard manna. Our wonderful God and gracious Father, you are so good to us. You made a beautiful, good, perfect world, and we wrecked it. But it's still beautiful, and it's still good, and you are still with us. You haven't given up on us. You pack every day with so many blessings, so much beauty, so much joy. And if we're not finding it, it's because we're not looking in the right place. Help us, Lord, more and more to look to you. You are wonderful, amazing, the source of every good and perfect gift. Your plan for us, ultimately, is that we will glorify and enjoy you forever. You bless your people with joy. May your joy be upon us. Help us to really enjoy everything that you've given us. And to be generous, and to share, and to spread that joy all around.